gives us a sense of the way he was thinking. It gives us a sense, 1939, of the centrality of philosophical thinking for him, not just in the undergraduate classroom of Yeshiva College teaching Jewish philosophy, but also in the big world.
As we now enter into this third lecture, what should we expect to encounter?
To some extent, a surprise. After having determined and tried to argue in the second lecture about the centrality of Jewish life and Jewish law and Jewish living, and how important that was for Rabbi Soloveitchik, we are now going to encounter a different Rabbi Soloveitchik, a Rabbi Soloveitchik that made significant room in his worldview, both again biographically as well as conceptually, for a whole world outside that of the immediacy of the Beit Midrash or the study hall, the traditional place where Talmud is studied. We're going to see somebody who was very much committed to worldly knowledge, going to Berlin and actually taking it quite seriously, writing a dissertation on Hermann Cohen, a so-called neo-Kantian, steeped in the world of philosophy. And we're going to encounter someone who is engaged in the world, not just conceptually or intellectually, drawing upon the wisdom of the world for his purposes and for the points that he wants to make, but also being engaged in the world and arguing for being engaged in the world, for actually practically playing a role in the world, in what is probably the most famous example of this in his presentation of the two stories of Adam at the beginning of Genesis. There are two Adams. We're going to encounter a private, a personal Adam, but we're also going to encounter the first Adam, is someone who wants to conquer, someone who's engaged, someone who expends an enormous amount of effort, appropriately and properly, in making the world a better place, who builds hospitals, who flies airplanes, who cares about the world and who is invested in the world. This is also Rabbi Soloveitchik, and this is part of the greatness of Rabbi Soloveitchik, that he's multifaceted, I believe not mutually exclusively contradictory here. We're talking about two aspects of a life that live together with one another, but each one needs to be understood first independently and then together.
My last presentation dealt with the centrality of Torah and Halakha in the worldview of Rabbi Soloveitchik, and I focused on the ideology that I refer to as the Torah-only ideology. I'd like for this unit to expand the focus of Rabbi Soloveitchik's interests and to examine the role that worldly wisdom, the wisdom of the world, as opposed to specifically or exclusively Torah wisdom, played for him in his conception of Judaism and the world. I deliberately don't want to call it secular wisdom. He does, on occasion, as we will see, call it secular wisdom, because it's not secular in the sense that we normally associate with that word, but it's something that he himself would, I think, also agree had very important and significant religious value. And for him, the knowledge of the world was a part of his understanding of the role of the Jew and his understanding of his role in the world at large. Precisely because both of these were so important for Rabbi Soloveitchik, namely, on the one hand, the Torah only, on the other hand, what we're going to be calling the Torah and, the absolute commitment and fealty to Torah study and to a halachic life practice together with an understanding and an appreciation of the wisdom of the world and the obligation to do something about it, to practically implement that knowledge. Because he had both, this enabled him and enables us to appreciate him, enabled him to continue to have such an extraordinary impact on the world, even well into the 21st century. I want to begin with an irony or with a paradox. I already had occasion to note a number of times that Rabbi Soloveitchik presented ideas typologically. He formulated his thinking and his philosophy by presenting various human types. So we have halachic man, and I already talked to you about the man part of that phrase. Halachic man, the lonely man of faith. And he writes about Rosh Hashanah man, or Yom Kippur man. These are two different, interesting holidays, very important in the Jewish calendar, different from one another, each one a typology representing a person. He writes about breastplate man and frontlet man. These are different parts of the costume of the various garments worn by the high priest. Each one was different. Each one was a typology. So wherever we look, Rabbi Soloveitchik repeatedly talks about typologies, presents his ideas by referring to a person, a kind of a person, and that person represents the point that he's trying to make. The irony is that nowhere did he describe the type of person that he was. Nowhere did he ever describe or characterize a Torah and general culture man, somebody who is committed deeply to both, obviously to Torah, but also to the value of learning and implementing living general knowledge. Both were central. He never talked about it. He doesn't present to us a model of this type, someone who was both a Torah scholar and a philosopher. What is someone who values these two bodies of knowledge like? What is this person thinking about? What are his experiences? What are the actions that are characteristic of his life? These are exactly what he discusses in halachic man, but does not at all ever anywhere discuss it in halachic plus general culture man. So we're left to our own devices to try to explain what this typology, this new kind of a man, meant for him. And I want to do so on two levels. Number one, biographical, and number two, conceptual. I already made the point that we really need to see both of them very much intertwined one with the other, and we can't separate biography and ideas. Even in the world of conceptual, I also want to see it on two levels. Number one, on the theoretical level, the value of understanding and the use of general knowledge in our perception of what Judaism is. And then on the more practical level, to take that knowledge and to not just leave it in the rarefied atmosphere of our brains or in the library, but actually to move into the world to make a practical difference in the world around us. As I noted in Unit 1, Rabbi Soloveitchik's formative years were spent not only in front of a Talmudic book, in front of many Talmudic books, studying primarily with his father, but also in the university. I already indicated to you when he was 22, 23 years of age, he left the comfort, the familiar traditional Torah-centric world of his family, and he moved to the secular metropolis of Berlin to study philosophy in that university. In an essay published in 1963, his younger son-in-law wrote the following, source number one. When he was 22, 1963, Rabbi Lichtenstein published an appreciation, I would say, of the life up until that point and of the major interests of his father-in-law. And early on in the essay, when he's describing the biography of his father-in-law, he wrote, when he was 22, Rabbi Soloveitchik entered the University of Berlin. For the first time, approached the serious study of a secular, here we go, secular discipline. I think it's just an easy way how to describe it without having to say, well, it's not really specifically Torah discipline. But again, I want to caution you that I don't believe it's secular in the sense of secular meaning unrelated to or separate from or not connected to some kind of a religious significance. His chosen field was philosophy. At the university, he plunged into the more abstract and abstruse aspects of philosophy, focusing his interest on the study of logic, metaphysics, and epistemology. In all these areas, particularly the last two, the current approach was influenced by the thought and philosophy of Kant, and Soloveitchik steeped himself in Kantianism and its dicta. So this is now far from the traditional Talmudic study hall. He is now deeply engaged. He threw himself into this entirely different kind of a discipline. As I also shared with you in unit number one, his doctorate is dated December 10th, 1932, by which time, as I mentioned to you, he and his wife and young daughter were already living in Boston. A couple of years later, Rabbi Soloveitchik began teaching Jewish philosophy at Yeshiva College in New York. It was not yet a university, it was a college. It was a college where there were secular studies, and it was also a yeshiva, the Rabbi Isaac Ochanan Theological Seminary. His father was serving as the dean, as the head of the Talmud faculty, and Rabbi Soloveitchik was invited, living in Boston, to commute regularly to New York, not to teach Talmud, but to teach Jewish philosophy. We have source number two, an undergraduate exam that Rabbi Soloveitchik, Dr. Soloveitchik, administered to his students in the undergraduate course in philosophy that he taught. I found it in the archives of Yeshiva University. Final examination, June 5th, 1936, Jewish philosophy, doctor. Again, Dr. Joseph Soloveitchik. Now, I just want to point to a couple of questions, and we'll see that they will become shortly very significant. 2A, what is the Jewish attitude on the problem of the normative, affective, and cognitive approach to the religious act? 3A, how can we explain the two contradictory phenomena in our religious consciousness, dependence, and freedom? 4A, the problem of ta'amei ha-mitzvot, which means the reasons for the commandments, or maybe the rationales for the commandments, was a huge issue in medieval Jewish philosophy to try to understand what's behind the commandment. Yes, I know the reason why I'm doing it is because I believe that God told me to do it and God wants me to do it. But now that I'm doing it, what difference is it going to make? How is it going to affect me? What's the point of this particular commandment? And the question was, explain in connection with the subjectivity and objectivity in the religious consciousness. So all I could think of is, on the one hand, gee, I wish I was in that class. And on the other hand, oh my God, thank God I was not in that class. Because as an undergraduate, so I'm 19 years old, I'm 20 years old, so it would have been amazing, but I would have been intimidated beyond description. And then to be confronted with this exam is an experience that I am grateful I did not have to undergo. From the biographical evidence, so here we have somebody who studied in the university. We saw a little bit what he studied, got a PhD in philosophy, taught Jewish philosophy. We got a sense a little bit of the questions that he asked. I want to now move a little bit to some of his writings, and I would want to begin with a letter in source number three. This is a letter that Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote to Rabbi Dr. Leo Young. Rabbi Dr. Leo Young at that point was the rabbi of the Jewish Center, a synagogue that still exists on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And Rabbi Young was a very prominent rabbi who was very interested in bringing complicated notions of Judaism to the attention of the broad spectrum of the American Jewish community. It was an Orthodox congregation, a rabbi who cared about all Jews, wanted to help raise the level of knowledge of all Jews, and was involved with publishing what he called the Jewish Library, a whole series of volumes where every essay was able to, and the goal was for it to be able to explain concepts of Judaism in a way that would be understood by a very broad audience. We don't have Rabbi Young's letter to Rabbi Soloveitchik, but we have Rabbi Soloveitchik's letter back. It was my own personal privilege in 1981 to become the rabbi of that congregation. I served in that congregation for close to 20 years. And when I got there in 1981, Rabbi Young was 90 years old. He was still alive. I developed a very warm, I would even say a loving relationship with him. And when he passed away, I went through all of his papers. He left them in the archives of the synagogue, and I had occasion to go through all of his papers. And I found this letter. So I have here the original of the letter. You have a copy of it in your handout on source number 3. I want to read it to you for two reasons. Number one, because it's important and interesting philosophically. And number two, as I keep on trying to point out, we need to know the person Rabbi Soloveitchik, the human being Rabbi Soloveitchik, not just the brain Rabbi Soloveitchik, or even the heart Rabbi Soloveitchik. Now notice the date. I'm always, maybe because I'm a historian, I always look at the date. I'm very upset when I ever read anything without a date. It could be a rabbinic responsum, it could be a letter. Like, you need to know when it was written. You need to know what's going on. Unbelievable, September 5th, 1939. Things are happening in the world on September 5th, 1939. The whole world is beginning to just crumble. World War II. Germany invaded Poland September 1st, starting the Second World War. It's September 5th. Rabbi Soloveitchik was living in Roxbury. It's a suburb of Boston. Dr. Leo Young, and the address is the address of the congregation on West 86th Street in Manhattan. Upon my return home from Chicago, I found in my mail your letter of August 14. Please accept my thanks for your invitation to write an essay on a Jewish philosophical subject to be published in the fifth volume of the Jewish Library. So I told you there's a whole series of books that Rabbi Young is interested in publishing to publicize and to be able to explain traditional Judaism to a very wide audience. We're now up to volume 5. It's about to come out. He invites Rabbi Soloveitchik to contribute an essay on a Jewish philosophical subject. After consideration, I arrived at the decision to avail myself of this offer and contribute a chapter to your publication with the following reservations, however. And now he numbers them. Number 1. I regret to say that I don't find the topic you suggested to my interest. It is very doubtful whether the Musar movement was a 19th century East-West European movement that focused on the ethical betterment of every human being. It's not so much focused on the law, it's focused on the personality, we make ourselves better. And this was a very prominent and very important movement. Rabbi Young clearly suggested that Rabbi Soloveitchik should write an essay on that subject. I'm not interested. I'm not interested because I'm very doubtful whether the Musar movement can at present be subjected to an exact philosophical analysis. And if it can't be subjected to an exact philosophical analysis, I'm not interested. That is my focus. That's what I want to do. It's not going to happen in the Musar movement. I would rather choose as my subject the following problem. Quote, get ready for the ride. The neo-Kantian conception of the Subjectivity and Objectification Act and its application to the analysis of the Tamei HaMitzvot problem. That's what I want to do. Now, I just showed you the course he was teaching, undergraduate course in Jewish philosophy. I showed you the question that deals exactly with this issue. It's on his mind. He just taught it. Maybe he taught it again. And this is what he wants to write. And this is what he wants to write in the Jewish Library, in a place that is designated to explain complicated notions of Judaism to a broad range of general American Jews. And then he explains why he wants to do this. The interpretation of this central thought in the neo-Kantian philosophy will prove to be of great value for the elucidation of basic problems of modern Jewish philosophy. Few dissertations were written on Hermann Cohen's philosophy of religion based upon his book. Rabbi Soloveitchik himself wrote a dissertation on this subject, but as yet no attempt has been made to evaluate Cohen's theoretical philosophy as a source of modern Jewish thought. How are we going to relate that to Judaism? My intention is to exploit this latter field for the purpose of enriching our philosophico-religious aspect. So that's number one. I'm happy to do it. I'm not doing what you want me to do. Here's what I want to do. Here's why I want to do it. Number two, I cannot accept any limitation for my essay as to the amount of words. This is not a magazine article which can be shortened or expanded according to wish. I will write as much as the full covering of this topic will require. It may be less, and it may be more than 8,000 words. That's number two. I'm happy to do it, but my terms, not your terms. If these conditions are in line with your tentative plan for the publication, please inform me at your earliest convenience with greetings for a happy new year, Joseph Soloveitchik. So suffice it to say that no article entitled, taking a deep breath, The Neo-Kantian Conception of Subjectivity and Objectification Act and Its Application to the Analysis of the Tamei HaMitzvah Problem ever appeared in any of the publications of the Jewish Library. Volume 5 appeared, Volume 6 appeared, and this wasn't in it. Gives us a sense of the way he was thinking. It gives us a sense, 1939, of the centrality of philosophical thinking for him, not just in the undergraduate classroom of Yeshiva College teaching Jewish philosophy, but also in the big world. This is now obviously an essay that is meant to have an impact on the broader community. Second of all, I want to show you another source that was written just a couple of years later. In the last unit, Unit 2, I spoke about his work, Halachic Man, where he presents a typology of a person. I mentioned it at the beginning of this presentation as well. Somebody whose life is fully encompassed by that person's fealty to halachic practice and to Torah study, a Torah-only kind of a personality. Yet you can't be struck by the fact that in this presentation, designed to describe and explain and unpack what's going on in the life and the experience of someone who lives one's life that way, he draws on sources outside of the traditional halachic corpus. The broad range of general philosophical knowledge that Rabbi Soloveitchik exhibited in this work, I would even say the breathtaking broad range of knowledge, is obvious to anybody who reads it. You read the first couple of pages and you read the first couple of footnotes, and it's just incredible. And it was noted in the eulogy that was written for Rabbi Soloveitchik by his older son-in-law, by my teacher, Professor Tversky, source number 4. Beginning of the paragraph, if you knew nothing about the Rav, about my father-in-law's, Rabbi Soloveitchik's biography, you didn't know anything about him, you didn't know anything about the University of Berlin, you didn't know anything about philosophy in terms of his formal study of philosophy, and merely studied the Ish HaHalacha, which is Hebrew for halachic man, that was published in 1944, you would confront a massive strategic reliance on the history of philosophy and science. The first two pages introduce you to Hegel, Kierkegaard, Rudolf Otto, Karl Barth, Edward Spranger, Ferdinand Lassalle, Rousseau, Nietzsche, Bergson, Spengler, and Heidegger, a breathtaking list. Parenthesis, a breathtaking list indeed. A page later, and this is halachic man. This is, he's talking about somebody who lives his entire life in the world of Torah only. A page later, you meet Plato, Aristotle, Galileo, Newton, soon thereafter, Husserl, Scheler, Berkeley, Hermann Cohen. If you persisted and made your way to the end of this remarkable philosophical spiritual meditation, the very last note refocuses your attention on a cast of influential figures, Kant, Hermann Cohen, Kierkegaard, Ibsen, Scheler, Heidegger, together with the Rambam, Maimonides, Ibn Gabir, and once again, after a passing reference to Duns Scotus, on to Schopenhauer and Nietzsche. In a book meant to describe a Torah-only personality. These references reflect not only a great erudition and precision in the history of philosophy, it's not just that he knew it, but he thought that way. It also reflects a philosophic temper, a philosophic mode of thinking, a subtle and analytic mind. The irony is that the halachic man being described in Halachic Man could never, ever, ever begin to understand the halachic man being described in Halachic Man. That halachic man being described had no clue, had no idea, and frankly had no interest in finding out anything about any one of these figures who Rabbi Soloveitchik liberally and intensely and powerfully and deeply brought in to this conversation. And so we have repeated examples of the use of philosophy, the use of German 19th century neo-Kantian philosophy in his developing conceptual worldview of what Judaism was. It is interesting for me, and actually I would even say puzzling to me, that Rabbi Soloveitchik not only never described himself, the type of person he was, but he never presented a justification or even a rationale or an explanation for the value of the study of worldly knowledge or philosophy. You need to understand that this was highly controversial. It was highly controversial in his own family, in his own Torah-only upbringing. It was a scandal in the Torah-only world when he lived, a scandal that a grandson of his grandfather, Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, who was the paradigmatic exemplar of Torah only, that he should have a grandson who should turn his back on this tradition and go to study philosophy in the University of Berlin. It was outrageous. It was outrageous. They couldn't understand it. And then hitched his star to a yeshiva that was also a university. He was attacked for this. He was distanced because of this from the Torah-only world. He was disrespected and denigrated in the Torah-only world. He was a traitor in the Torah-only world. And one would have imagined, I don't know anything about how he reacted to this personally. I never discussed it with him. I'm always very careful. I don't project anything. But it's just interesting to me that he never felt the need to, I'm not saying to apologize. I'm not even saying justify. What I am saying is to explain. Why is this important? Why is this important for me? Why is it that all my children have doctorates? Why is it that my two sons-in-law have doctorates? Why is it that my grandchildren who are living in Boston all went to Harvard University and did not go to Yeshiva University for undergraduate school? Why is that important? Personally for me, for my students, for my world, he did not do it. And so here again, we have to somehow look a little bit here and look a little bit there and put together from here and from there some kind of a picture to explain the centrality of this for Rabbi Soloveitchik. And why it's puzzling to me is because it's not obvious. The context of the world in which he lived, it's not obvious, and he paid a heavy price for this insistence on going to university. It was a time in my life when I was in high school. I was in a right-wing traditional yeshiva, and then I studied in a right-wing traditional yeshiva in Israel. And my father, who I mentioned to you, was very close with Rabbi Soloveitchik, was once driving him somewhere in a car, and he sort of unloaded to Rabbi Soloveitchik how disappointed my father was in me, that I didn't want to go to college, I just wanted to study Torah all day, and Rabbi Soloveitchik got agitated. He must go to college, he must go to college. So it ended up that I ended up going to college, but this was so central to him. Here I want to study Torah all day, I mean it's a beautiful thing. No, he must go to college. Why? Why must he go to college? What's wrong with studying Torah all day? If somehow you could live a life and you could be supported and you could get a great job teaching Torah, so great. I mean, what could be more important? Unit 2, Torah only. I love Torah. It's all I do, 4 cubits of halakha. He never explained it. I once asked his son, Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, why didn't your father ever explain why college is important? So he said to me, he just assumed it was important. I said to him, what are you talking about? You gotta be kidding. And he shrugged his shoulders. I don't really know why he never did, but he didn't. And because he didn't, so it's harder for us because it matters. It matters to understand this very central aspect of his life and of his interests. And so we need to try to figure it out, and I will do so in the course of the remainder of this presentation. But I want to take it on 2 levels. I want to take it not just on knowing philosophy and living in the world of all of those incredibly sophisticated and important non-Jewish philosophers mentioned by Rabbi Soloveitchik, whose thought was so centrally important to him in his Halachic Man article and elsewhere. But I also want to focus on the practical engagement with the world. And here we're moving away from the 4 cubits of halacha that he described at the end of the previous presentation that I discussed with you. We're not just living. We're not just living in the Talmudic study hall. We're living in the world, and the world matters, and it matters because I have to learn from the world, and it matters because I have to contribute to the world in very practical ways. One of Rabbi Soloveitchik's most illustrious students, the late Rabbi Walter Wurzberger, wrote the following in source number 5. He was convinced, Rabbi Soloveitchik was convinced, that if Torah values were perceived as incompatible with modernity's emphasis upon human responsibility for our socio-political and economic situation, the bulk of Jewry would dismiss Torah as totally irrelevant. It was his fear, it was Rabbi Soloveitchik's fear, that a religious ethos which disparaged all human initiatives in ameliorating socio-political conditions, and one that frowned upon any involvement with the trappings of modernity, that's a nice way how to describe the Torah-only society. For Rabbi Soloveitchik, he was afraid that if that were the case, that could at best result in halachically committed Jews being marginalized and relegated to a ghettoized existence on the periphery of Jewish life. It was his, Rabbi Soloveitchik's, unshakable faith that Torah is a Torah of life, not an escape from it, that inspired him to search for formulations that would not only grudgingly condone secular studies and scientific, technological, industrial, commercial, and political activities. Notice the double focus, the study, the knowledge, the wisdom, and the activity that unfolds in technology, industry, commerce, and politics. But it's not just to grudgingly condone this, but as long as they fully conform to halachic standards, would fully endorse them as intrinsically desirable and actually proactively, I'm adding, religiously valuable. In Rabbi Soloveitchik's view, the Jew needed to live in the world, needed to engage the world, needed to contribute to the world, and needed to benefit from the world. We are going to, in Unit 7, analyze in great detail a very famous essay written by Rabbi Soloveitchik. The primary focus of this essay is Jewish-Christian dialogue. It was written in the middle of the whole discussion in the cataclysmic change that the church was considering in the early 60s in totally revamping its conception of Jews and Judaism and its relationship to Jews and Judaism. That's what the article is mostly about. It's called Confrontation. It's a confrontation between the Jewish community and, in this particular case, the Catholic community. But in the course of this, and very much related to this, towards the end of the article, he does an analysis in source 6 of the confrontation between Jacob and Esau in Genesis chapter 32. Jacob and Esau as the sort of paradigmatic, the confrontation between Jews and those who are outside of the Jewish community. "When Esau, my brother, meeteth thee," this is towards the end of this passage in source number 6. And this is a translation of a verse in this chapter. And he is telling his entourage, he's preparing them for this encounter. "When Esau, my brother, meets you and asks you, who are you, whither goest thou, and who are these before you? My brother Esau," Jacob told his agents, his people who were surrounding him, "will address three questions." There are three questions. If you parse the verse, you'll notice that there are three questions. Whose art thou? Number one. Whither goest thou? Number two. And number three, whose are these before you? And Rabbi Soloveitchik analyzes these three questions and points to differences between them in terms of their emphasis and in terms of the answers that he was expecting his group to respond when confronted by these questions. "My brother Esau," Jacob told his agents, "will address to you three questions. Whose art thou?" Namely, "To whom do you as a metaphysical being, as a soul, as a spiritual personality belong?" Now, we're not just talking any longer specifically about Esau, but about the type, back to typology, the representative type of an Esau, of another religion that's going to confront this religion and ask these questions. Question number one: "To whom do you as a metaphysical being, as a soul, as a spiritual personality belong?" Question number two: "And whither goest thou? To whom is your historical destiny committed? To whom have you consecrated your future? What is your ultimate goal, your final objective? Who is your God, and what is your way of life?" These are the first two questions. These two inquiries are related to your identity as members of a covenantal community, a very prominent phrase in Rabbi Soloveitchik's writing, referring to the Jewish community as a covenantal community, having engaged in a covenant with God, God, the Jewish people, the Jewish people, and God, the Jewish people, therefore a covenantal community. These two questions relate to your Jewish, your exclusive, specific, personal, intimate, inner Jewish identity. "However," Jacob continued, said Rabbi Soloveitchik, "my brother Esau will also ask a third question. And the third question is, and who are these before thee?" What's the question? "Are you ready to contribute your talents, capabilities, and efforts toward the material and cultural welfare of general society? Are you ready to present me with gifts and oxen and goats and camels and bulls? Are you willing to pay taxes to develop and industrialize the country?" This third inquiry, unlike the first two, is focused on temporal aspects of life. As regards the third question, Jacob told his agents to answer in the positive. And the answer is, the Hebrew translated into English, "It is a present unto my Lord, even unto Esau." What does that mean? Yes, we are determined. And here's a very important passage where Rabbi Soloveitchik makes clear his commitment to the world at large, to what I'm calling Torah, and not just conceptually and theoretically and intellectually, but practically. Yes, we are determined to participate in every civic, scientific, and political enterprise. We feel obligated to enrich society with our creative talents to be constructive and useful citizens. We don't live in a hermetically sealed culture and society. We're with you, we're in with you, we're connected to you, we're obligated to you, we're engaged with you. This is important to us, yes. Yet pertaining to the first two questions, namely, whose art thou and whither goest thou? Jacob commanded his representatives to reply in the negative, clearly and precisely, boldly and courageously. He commanded them to tell Esau that their soul, their personality, their metaphysical destiny, their spiritual future and sacred commitments, those belong exclusively to God and to his servant Jacob. They are thy servant Jacob's. And no human power can succeed in severing the eternal bond between them and God. And so we see here, yes, questions number one and two, intimate, personal, covenantal, Jewish, religious, connected to God. Yes. But what is striking is the third answer to the third question. And that is, when it comes to engaging with the world, we are with you 100%. And I'm gonna quote it again, we are determined to participate in every is a very strong word, every. Not just some, and not just maybe, and not just sometimes. We are determined is also a strong word, not just, you'll twist my arm, maybe once in a while, I'll be in a good mood. We are determined to participate in every civic, scientific, political enterprise. We feel obligated. It's not optional. It's not maybe, maybe not, obligated, required. We're obligated. It's a big word for someone who's rooted in a traditional Jewish way of life. We feel obligated not just to do the 613 commandments that we believe God presented to us in the Bible. We're obligated to enrich society with our creative talents and to be constructive and useful citizens. In 1971, source number 7, Rabbi Soloveitchik gave a talk to the parent body of the school that he and his wife had founded in 1937, a couple of years after they came first to Boston. He would meet with the student body regularly. I think I mentioned to you that he continued to live in Boston all these years. On Tuesday morning, he would fly to New York. He would teach in the afternoon, Tuesday afternoon and Wednesday, and then very often Thursday morning. By Thursday evening, he was back in Boston. I was a student of his son-in-law. His son-in-law had a little small synagogue or a prayer space that he presided over, and I prayed there on a regular basis. So I would say goodbye to Rabbi Soloveitchik on Tuesday morning, and I would say hello to Rabbi Soloveitchik on Thursday evening. He would, by then, already be living. He was living with his daughter and son-in-law. His wife had passed away. We'll come back to this again in 1967. And his place of worship was in this little synagogue run by his son-in-law, who simultaneously was the Litauer professor of Jewish studies, Jewish history, Jewish thought, Jewish literature at Harvard. And he was away for those 3 days during the week. And on weekends, he would often go to the school to visit, walk around, see what's going on. He had a very intense interest in the school. And not only did he interact with the student body, but he also interacted with the parents. And every once in a while, the PTA of the school would prevail upon him to meet with the next crop of parents. You know, students don't last forever, there are always parents coming in, and give them an opportunity to understand what the school is all about. It was a big cachet that Rabbi Soloveitchik was associated with this school and meant a lot to the leadership of the school that he continued to be identified with it and would present its ideology and philosophy. So on November 15th, 1971, he gives an address, and this is not the only time. I have at home a number of different transcripts of a number of different talks that he gave on different occasions. But this is the one that was published in a little pamphlet that was put out by the Maimonides School, and so I bring it to your attention. On the bottom left of source number 7, what do we at Maimonides believe? We believe that the Jewish child is capable of carrying a double load, the universal secular. Here he uses the word secular, but again, I don't think he would insist that it's secular the way we understand secular, but just a way of saying not just Jewish. Universal, secular, and specific Judaic. We believe that the child is able to study and comprehend two systems of knowledge, and not just to understand them, but to actually excel in both of them. Some people deny it. The Jewish child, they say, has to choose between being a literate Jew and a literate human being. Literacy in both realms, they say, is an absurdity. We, parenthesis, however, reject this philosophy of doom. We say the Jewish child is teachable and educationable in both fields and at the same time. Not only literacy, but even scholarship in both is attainable. We also believe that the Jewish child is capable of mastering both scientific and biblico-Talmudic knowledge, not only from an educational technical viewpoint. In other words, you can study both at the same time and understand it and excel in it and even produce scholarship in it, but also from an axiological viewpoint. In other words, secular scientific training does not have to undermine the child's commitment to Torah values and commandments. Skip a little bit. One may serve God by building a house or by healing the sick. You could build a house and you're serving God. You heal the sick, you're serving God, provided that that person is aware that he can accomplish nothing without divine help. The most well-known and famous formulation of Rabbi Soloveitchik on this theme is found at the beginning of his extremely important work entitled The Lonely Man of Faith. It was first published as an article in the journal Tradition in 1965, and then, since then, it has been repeatedly republished in many different versions as a book. So I'm bringing you four different versions, which clearly goes to tell you that it's an important book, probably the most famous essay that was published by Rabbi Soloveitchik. And it's in this work, especially the beginning of this work, where we find the clearest, fullest exposition of Rabbi Soloveitchik's insistence upon engaging with the world at large. The beginning of the essay, Rabbi Soloveitchik noted four differences between the account of creation of Adam and Eve presented in the first chapter in Genesis and the account of the creation of Adam and Eve presented, and not even Adam and Eve in both cases, presented in the second chapter of Genesis. And from these, what he calls, quote, major discrepancies, end quote, he derives the notion that there are two different Adams, what he calls Adam 1 of chapter 1 and what he calls Adam 2 of chapter 2. And I want to read from this text. Once again, I've told you before, no one can better present Rabbi Soloveitchik than Rabbi Soloveitchik himself. And we are now in source number 8. After going through an analysis of the difference between these two chapters, he then moves on to what are the implications of the difference between these two chapters. And he provides, once again, not surprisingly, a typology. There's this kind of an atom and this kind of an atom. And if you understand these two atoms, you will then understand why chapter 1 is presented the way it's presented and chapter 2 the way it's presented. Let us portray these two men, Adam the first and Adam the second, in, no surprise, typological categories. There is no doubt, I'm going to read now liberally because I really do believe that the best way to do this is by him speaking for himself, and I will summarize at the end. There's no doubt that the term image of God in the first account refers to man's inner charismatic endowment as a creative being, underline creative, extremely important, as a very powerful aspect, fundamental aspect of Adam the first. Man's likeness to God, right, man being created in the image of God, that means that there's a connection between man, and again, I'm using the word man. Man is closely connected to God. Man's likeness to God expresses itself in man's striving and ability to become a creator. So God is a creator, so if I'm in the image of God, so I too am a creator. Adam the first, who was fashioned in the image of God, was blessed with great drive for creative, here it is again, creative activity, and immeasurable resources for the realization of this goal, the most outstanding of which is the intelligence, the human mind, capable of confronting the outside world and inquiring into its complex workings. Skip a few lines. God, in imparting the blessing to Adam the first and giving him the mandate to subdue nature, that is part of the formulation in chapter 1, subdue nature, take nature, subdue nature. God, by mandating that of Adam, parenthesis the first, directed Adam's attention to the functional and practical aspects of his intellect, through which man is able to gain control, keyword, control over nature. Skip a little bit. Adam the first is interested in just a single aspect of reality and asks one question. This may be familiar to you by now. How does the cosmos function? He is not fascinated by the question, why does the cosmos function? Once again, it's not the why question, it's the how question, because the how question is the practical question. So what difference is it going to make? What am I going to do about it? We saw that earlier already in another context. He's only curious to know how it works. In fact, even the how question with which Adam the first is preoccupied is limited in scope. He's concerned not with the question per se, it's not a theoretical question for him, but with its practical implications. He raises not a metaphysical, but a practical, technical how question. Next page, page 14 in the edition that I bring to your attention. A couple of lines down on the left side, Adam the first is overwhelmed by one quest, namely to harness and dominate the elemental natural forces and put them at his disposal. He's a creator, he dominates, he harnesses, he gains control. Bottom of the page, man is an honorable being. Now Rabbi Soloveitchik introduces another concept very much related to and stemming out of this. In other words, man is a dignified being. Dignity. And to be human means to live with dignity. What is dignity and how can it be realized? Bottom of the page, dignity was equated by the psalmist with man's capability of dominating, is another word, controlling, dominating, creating. Dominating his environment and exercising control over it. Man acquires dignity through glory, through his majestic posture vis-a-vis his environment. Page 17 now in the edition that I bring to your attention, man of old, and here is where, again, there's a very clear practical description of what Rabbi Soloveitchik considers to be centrally important. Man of old who could not fight disease and succumbed in multitudes to yellow fever or any other plague with degrading helplessness could not lay claim to dignity. Only the man who builds hospitals, discovers therapeutic techniques, and saves lives is blessed with dignity. This is not describing somebody who spends his full time in the study hall studying Torah. Men of the 17th and 18th centuries who needed several days to travel from Boston to New York, that was clearly Rabbi Soloveitchik's frame of reference, he's thinking about going Boston to New York, but in the 17th and 18th century, it took several days to do that, was less dignified than modern man, who attempts to conquer space, boards a plane at the New York airport at midnight, and takes several hours later a leisurely walk along the streets of London. The brute is helpless and therefore not dignified. Civilized man has gained limited control of nature and has become in certain respects her master, and with his mastery has attained dignity as well. Next page, hence Adam the First is aggressive, bold, and victory-minded. His motto is success, triumph over the cosmic forces. He engages in creative work, trying to imitate his maker. And there is more about Adam the First. Adam the First is ambitious. Adam the First wants to build. Adam the First wants to create, is mandated to build and to create, to produce, to discover, to act, to heal the sick, to build buildings, and to invent a faster airplane. Adam the Second, page 21, is like Adam the First, also intrigued by the cosmos. But Adam the Second is different. Just a little bit more at the bottom of page 22, top of page 23. Adam the Second, and Rabbi Soloveitchik, I find, spends more time describing Adam the First than Adam the Second. Adam the Second does not apply the functional method invented by Adam the First. Adam the Second is not functional, is not practical, is not practically engaged. He does not create a world of his own, which is what Adam the First does. Adam the First is a partner to God in creation. Adam the First is a creator. Adam the First creates a world of his own. That's not of interest to Adam the Second. Instead, he wants to understand the living, given world into which he has been cast. I don't have to create a new world. I got a world. Okay, this is the world. So now I want to understand it. I want to relate to it. And we'll see in a moment, I want to relate to God who created it. He encounters the universe in all its colorfulness, splendor, grandeur, studies it with the naivete, awe, and admiration of a child who seeks the unusual and wonderful in every ordinary thing and event. While Adam the First is dynamic and creative, transforming sensory data into thought constructs, Adam the Second is receptive, it's passive, and beholds the world in its original dimensions as it currently exists. He looks for the image of God in every beam of light, in every bud and blossom, in the morning breeze, the stillness of a starlit evening. In a word, Adam the Second explores not the scientific abstract universe, but the irresistibly fascinating qualitative world where he establishes an intimate relation to God. He seeks to understand the world as it is, not seeking to shape a new world or maybe a different world as he feels he is able to do so. And so we have here these two typologies, and clearly Adam the First is the most relevant to our Torah and conversation. We now are mandated to subdue the world. We are obligated to get out there and to make a difference. Adam one, or Adam the First is ambitious. He wants to build and create, to produce and discover. He wants to conquer and control. He wants to make. He wants to accomplish. He's guided by a quest for dignity, and he achieves that dignity by gaining control over his environment. He's active, creative, aggressive, this-worldly-minded, utilitarian, bold, fully engaged with the world, and is interested in achieving mastery over the world. He wants to, quote, fulfill the biblical obligation, quote, fill the earth and subdue it. By contrast, Adam II is introspective. What motivates him is not a quest for external dignity, but internal redemption. And he achieves that redemption by retreating into the privacy of his own personality and by establishing a personal and intimate relationship with God who created the world as he sees it and as he knows it. His interest is not in being creative, but in understanding that which has already been created. Instead of controlling or subduing environment, he wants to control himself. His focus is inner, personal, intimate. He is receptive rather than dynamic. Now, one of the most interesting questions to ask, and I invite you to consider it yourself, is it's obvious that every human being And we're not talking about a Jew here. Every human being, I told you, and I'll tell you again, that Rabbi Soloveitchik delivered this talk in front of a Christian seminary, a Catholic seminary in Brighton, Massachusetts, not far from his home. He's speaking to a Catholic religious community. It's clear that every person is both, that we have within us both Adam 1 and Adam 2. And I have spent a long time, and I'm still spending a long time trying to figure out, and I could best do this through myself, so I analyze myself, I try to understand myself, be a little self-aware and self-reflective. So how does that work? How does Adam 1 and Adam 2 work? Is it like when I'm 15, I'm Adam 1, and then when I'm 19, I'm Adam 2, and then when I'm 23, I'm both at the same time? So in the morning, I'm this, in the afternoon, I'm this. When I'm in this space, I'm this. When I'm in that space, I'm this. How does this actually work? And there are times when I thought I got it, and then I didn't get it. Right now, I'm not getting it. I'm not clear about how to bring Adam 1 and Adam 2 into one Adam. It's one person. There's this kind of an Adam, and there's that. They're all typologies. Clearly, typologies are always presented, especially by Rabbi Soloveitchik, in very stark terms, in order to be able to differentiate this from this. So this has to be presented in an extreme fashion, and this has to be presented in an extreme fashion. Clearly, they're not as extreme as the way they're presented in order to make the point. So what are they, and how do we understand it? It's not clear. But for our purposes in this unit, can there be a clearer formulation of Torah and not just quoting all of those 19th century German sources and articles, but actually requiring and obligating engagement with the world than the description of Rabbi Soloveitchik's of Adam 1 at the beginning of this essay, Lonely Man of Faith? In this unit, discussing Rabbi Soloveitchik's emphasis on engaging the world, I have highlighted Adam 1. But, as I just mentioned, Adam 2 is also important. The inner, the personal, the introspective, and the private Adam, whose goal is to establish and then further develop a personal relationship with God. And it will be to this second Adam, to this aspect of the human condition, that I will turn in my next unit, which will deal with relating to God through prayer and repentance. Thank you.
Rabbi Schachter, we left lecture 2 understanding that Rabbi Soloveitchik's mental world put a premium on living within the 4 cubits of halakha. But now in this third lecture, we discover a whole other dimension to his personality, another dimension to his intellectual interests. Why do you think general culture at the end of the day was so important, given his prodigious gifts and responsibilities he felt to traditional Torah study?
I think Rabbi Soloveitchik internalized the message that he received from his mother primarily, that in order for an individual in the first third of the 20th century, living in the Jewish world, to have a substantial impact on the world at large, first on the Jewish world and then beyond, that it was absolutely necessary for that individual to be exposed to and to internalize the knowledge and even some of the values of the culture of the world in which that person found themselves.
Even some of the values.
Even some of the values. By values, I mean appreciation of the complexity and multifaceted nature of truth, that there is truth in the world outside that of Torah. It's an explicit Talmudic statement that there's wisdom outside of Torah, and the wisdom represents something meaningful. And for him to make an impact on the world, it was necessary for him to do that without compromising the absolute centrality of Torah living and Torah study. Obviously, at this point, there's a zero-sum game. You can't study Torah all day and also go study at the University of Berlin. But even when he was in the University of Berlin, he spent most of his time studying Torah. I heard a beautiful story, a really fascinating story. And I must
preface that by saying that I'm a big skeptic about Rabbi Soloveitchik's stories, because everybody has a story and who knows. But this is a story that I heard from somebody who I trust immensely, who actually heard it from Rabbi Soloveitchik. This is one of the young boys at Yeshiva University used to care for him in his older years when he used to commute and spend a couple of days in New York. He would care for him, make sure he had his meals. He would do the pick him up at the airport. And he told me he once asked Rabbi Soloveitchik, like, what was it like being in the University of Berlin? Like, what happened to Torah study at the University of Berlin? And Rabbi Soloveitchik told him the story. He said there were a lot of great, great Talmudic geniuses who used to come to visit Berlin, because there was a very famous eye doctor. And they would come to this eye doctor, A, because he was extremely renowned, and second of all, because he wouldn't charge them, because he had a soft spot for great rabbinic scholars, and he would pro bono see them. So they would make their way through Berlin, and every time they would make their way through Berlin, they would want to see me, because they couldn't understand, why is a grandson of Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, how could this be that a grandson of Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik is studying in the University of Berlin? For Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, this was horrible. This was exactly the opposite of everything that was important to him. Now his own grandson, like, what's going on? What's happening with this fellow? What's? So they all came by, and they wanted to, they would get a sense of who I was, and they would start to talk Torah with me. And I was right there, toe-to-toe. I don't think he used the phrase toe-to-toe. He was, and I was totally engaged. And after a few minutes, all of a sudden it strikes him and says, how could this be? Wait a minute. You are so adept and so engaged and so immersed in the study of Torah that we've just had this conversation for the last 7 minutes, but you're in the University of Berlin. You're studying philosophy. So I said to them, said Rabbi Soloveitchik, it's very simple. When you study Torah, I study Torah. And when you say not nice things about me because I'm in the University of Berlin, that's when I'm going to the university. He sent his father a volume full of Torah thoughts by mail from Berlin that his son, Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, published a number of years ago. Full volume of Torah thoughts that he generated in those years when he was in Berlin. So we're not talking about somebody who had one part of their life devoted to Torah study and then hung up the Talmudic skates and picked up a whole other set of interests. This was part of his life all along. He expanded. He didn't substitute his focus. And for him, it was really important. He believed that there was wisdom there, and wisdom for a purpose, to be able to be situated, to make a real impact on the broader spectrum of the Jewish community and of the general.